Welcome to Functional Medicine Foundations podcast, where we explore root cause medicine, engage in conversation with functional and integrative medicine experts, and build community with like-minded health seekers. I'm your host, Amber Warren. Let's dig deeper. Welcome back, Amber Warren, your host here today. I am honored to have one of my favorite humans in front of me. Dr. Mario Bruce obtained his medical and pediatric specialty training at Loma Linda University in Southern California. He's a board-certified pediatrician, currently seeing patients out of our Meridian Wellness Center in Meridian, Idaho. And we've just been so honored to be able to do functional medicine with this brilliant physician. So welcome, Dr. Bruce.
You are too kind, way too kind.
Well, it was honestly, I've told a lot of people this story, but part of Sam and I's kind of dream and vision of owning a functional medicine clinic with the rest of our crew is really being able to do lifelong care, right? And so in starting to work in functional medicine just as a PA under Dr. Eberharder, thought, gosh, if we're really looking so far back as to gut health and, you know, just the beginning of life, it doesn't make sense really to think about having a full spectrum functional medicine clinic without having pediatrics as a part of that.
Yeah.
So we're honored to bring you on board 3 or 4 years ago. And why don't you share with us kind of your journey into functional medicine? Everyone has their own unique journey, and I'd love to share yours.
I will. First of all, fast forward to when you and I had our conversation about 4 years ago.
I like it.
Yeah. And then I'll sort of backtrack a little bit. And this, you know, our interaction during that initial interview process, and then my actual medical interview, you remember I came to see you, right? Because I wanted to see what your style was.
Yeah,
I was interviewing you just as much as you were interviewing me at that point.
So, talk about nervous. I was like, oh, great.
Yeah. And so one of my big takeaways, of course, from your consultation at that point was you need to fix your airway. I don't know if you remember that even.
Vaguely.
And so I took that seriously, and I spent the next 2.5 years fixing my airway. Fixing my mouth and fixing, you know, the issues that I was having with, sleep apnea and stuff like that. And so it really brought front and center focus some of the things that we tend to ignore in traditional medicine, you know. So so I am an import from Australia. When I was 10 years old, I think I told you, you folks, this when we interviewed. We moved when I was 10. LA for a year, moved up to Sacramento, went off to college. So I remember during those first days in college, you know, I was one of the first to actually attend college in our whole family. And so I was kind of walking that path alone without much guidance. And so my first love was some sort of science, you know, and engineering, electronics, that sort of thing was sort of my interest. Well, the colleges that I went to didn't have that sort of a pre-electronics, pre-engineering sort of training. So I sort of poked around, and the next best thing was pre-med, right? So I said, all right, I've got to do this, you know. This is about as close as I'm going to get. So down the biochemistry trail I went, did a minor in music performance, and that was a lot of fun. However, I quickly realized, you know, based on my personality, that performance raised so much anxiety, you know, performance anxiety, you know, to where I realized, I'm not going to be able to do this for, you know. So even an environment like this, you know, being interviewed is very anxiety producing, you know. And so so went through my undergrad, got accepted into med school. First couple of years were rough because basic science was a time when a lot of factoids are thrown at you just rapidly. And my brain works in such a way that I have to be able to hang those factoids onto real, something real. Okay. And so took a year off, you know, went and worked at the hospital there, you know, got my brain together, came back, finished the basic sciences, and then went into clinicals. And that's where I found my true calling. It was a lot of fun. So the first rotation was VA hospital, medicine, you know, taking care of a lot of the chronic recurring admissions, you know, alcoholics, you know, sad
people. PTSD, mental health struggles.
And so I realized, you know, this is Band-Aid stuff. I mean, I was seeing that already way back then. Second rotation was peds, direct contrast, absolutely direct contrast. And so it was a no-brainer for me, you know. So peds,
you loved it right away.
Right away. Cool. So finished up, you know, clinicals, went into residency down there, and just flew. I mean, it was grueling. It was hard. You know, residency back in those days was different than nowadays, you know.
Yeah.
They didn't...
No rules.
Yeah, no rules. Yeah, I mean, you were... I remember when I was senior resident in the pediatric intensive care, you went in and you were there for 30 days. You know, you know, you could go out and maybe get some sunshine here and there. You know,
adrenal
you
dysfunction were there. Didn't exist.
Oh, man. So then I thought, well, I like teaching the other residents, you know. I thought, you know, it'd be kind of fun to stick around and teach. You know, so my advisor, Dr. Ashwal, he's a pediatric neurologist down there, he said, you know, you can do this. He said, but you will be much more valuable if you went out, got some experience, came back, you know, a few years down the road and had something real world to share then, you know. So, you know, it made a lot of sense because they were trying to avoid inbreeding,
yep.
You know. Mm-hmm. And so went out, got a position up in Vancouver, Washington, started a clinic up there. I'm a good starter. I'm not a very good finisher. I've started, you know, several practices throughout my life, you know, as I'll tell you shortly. So met my wife there, you know, Sonia, and we decided it was just too wet for us, you know, so moved out here to Caldwell, actually, initially, started a peds clinic out there. It's still running as we speak, you know, so I think it's got two or three or four pediatricians out there now, along with the family docs. Brought a lot of my enthusiasm for the intensity of the ICU, because that was something I really had a passion for, you know. So I was doing some stuff out there in Caldwell in the little community hospital that was, you know, crazy.
Yeah.
You know, I remember having one little 6-month-old, 5-month-old with head injury, you know, with subdural hematomas. You know, we admitted to the adult ICU and was doing every other day subdural taps right there in the ICU, you know. And so staying in touch, you know, CTs, MRIs, staying in touch with... Dave Bettis, who was the neurologist out here at that time. Mm-hmm. And then a year down the road, the folks at Pediatric Associates, you know, called and said, you know, we like what you're doing out there. Why don't you come join us? So, we talked, and it was a hard decision, you know, but came and joined them. Ultimately, you know, that merged with Primary Health, and, of course, that's where Pediatric Associates is now. Mm-hmm. About 10 years into that, so this is where I, you know, I start things and I, you know, I move on. It's my ADHD.
Maybe that's what it is. Or are you just wanting to continue to better yourself?
Well, learn no, and grow. No, it's the ADHD.
Okay, fair. I was trying to give you something to run with.
And so in 2009, took off and started my own practice. And so for 10 years, I did my own practice there at Gem State Pediatrics, you know, under the... umbrella of St. Luke's. Yep. There. So when the Eagle St. Luke's started is kind of when we joined on, you know, and so had my office there. And after about 10 years, realized, you know, this ownership. So, and you may get some of this flavor, you know, running your own practice. When you are doing the admin side and you're doing the practice side, it's almost like sometimes a conflict of interest that evolves, you know. And so it became very problematic for me, you know. I would be taking care, you know, putting my heart and soul into these families, And then having to deal with financial issues, you know, what do you do with a family that never pays their bills, you know? Yeah. And so I said, all right, this is not for me.
And our training, our hearts aren't always for the business side of things. That's not necessarily our gift.
Yeah. So looked around the country, and I wanted to find a larger organization, you know, a bigger boat to float through the rough economic seas back then, you know, in 08-09. And so found the Mercy System out in the Midwest in Missouri. After interviewing several places, joined in there, joined a group of two other pediatricians and had a robust practice. It was a rural practice, you know. We joined on with University of Missouri Columbia School of Medicine. And so we were basically part of their professorship there, you know, so taught their medical students, you know. So a lot of the students that came down were just the brightest of the bright. Fabulous kids, you know. And so I had to sort of develop some approach to teach these kids, you know, not only the mechanistic side of science. They were getting plenty of that. How to do the human side, you know.
Yeah.
And so not you can't just deal with just the facts, you know, the lab values, you know, what do you do with the family who's broken, you know, the human side. Yeah. And so because it was a rural practice, we were doing everything, you know, the ERs, when they had trouble, they'd send them up to us, you know, we'd take care of them, you know, and had some good nursing staff, NICU, ex-NICU nurses, you know, that were very essential for what we were doing. Then went down to Springfield, helped them evolve a pediatric urgent clinic, you know, got that going, operated that almost like a peds ER. Then towards, I don't know, probably 2013, maybe 14, 15, interviewed with Children's Hospital of Philadelphia because they wanted to get their urgent clinic going and had some experience doing that, you know, and so... After getting accepted there, you know, and I'll come back a little bit to the, you know, the medical aspects of my journey. Sonia's condition started deteriorating, so I had to decline that position there. You know, that would have been fabulous.
Sonia's diagnosis, you didn't share.
Yeah, I'll come right back to that. Okay. So when I started the practice, or when I started into the practice in 2010 in the Midwest, Sonia was given a diagnosis of cancer. Okay, and so from then on, for the next 7 years, it was just a very difficult road. And those folks who've actually had to walk that road totally understand. You know, it's the initial shock of the diagnosis, and then of course you do the traditional stuff, you know, you do the surgery, you do the chemo, you do all this stuff, you know, and your pathway is up and down and up and down. But from the start to the finished, it's down, you know, you're up a little bit, you're down, you're up a little bit, you're down. For the first couple of years after that, you know, she seemed to do fairly well. And then of course the metastases started and the liver, the bone, the, you know, interfacing with all these different specialties. And so ultimately, it was 2015, 16, you know, we decided to come on back here because this is where the kids are, you know. And so by that time, she was having a lot of trouble, you know. At that point, you know, we were already dealing with significant liver metastases in the bone, just bone everywhere, you know. Yeah. And then I lost her basically in 2018. I'm having a hard time remembering anymore whether it was 17 or I think it was 2018 in May. And so prior to that, about a year prior to that, she developed a lot of brain metastases, you know. And so we ended up going up to Seattle, you know, and had some of their targeted radiation treatments. So about halfway into this course of, you know, 7 years of treating up and down, you know, I started looking into the alternative kinds of thinking, you know, the naturopathic, the chiropractic, you know, got in with some of the folks like Carl Felt Center, for example, here in Boise, and some of the naturopaths that really helped a lot. And I think that kind of intervention really did extend her life. But with the damage that our traditional approach created, I think that it was going to be hard to avoid the inevitable, you know. And so, you know, I used my CME money to buy books. I mean, I just loaded up and started reading, you know. And so, so that last year or so, I was pretty deep into trying to figure out alternate naturopathic kinds of treatments, maybe rethinking cancer causation, you know, as not being necessarily a genetic thing, but rather more of a mitochondrial thing, you know, which seems to not have taken off quite, you know, the cancer treatment community has not latched onto that because there's all the research money is into the genetics, right?
All the money.
Yeah. Yeah. All the money. And so then I got introduced to some of the functionally minded providers across the country, started listening to lectures, then got exposed to Institute of Functional Medicine, started some of their training courses, went off and did some you know, genetic studies with Bob Miller, who's a traditional naturopath, and he has his fabulous sort of takeoff on 23andMe, yep. You know, which I do use now in my practice.
That's your tree of life.
Tree of life, yeah.
You have implemented, yeah.
And so when I came back to Idaho, I joined up with St. Al's, mm-hmm. and I was there for about 3 years. And so at the end of that 3 years is when you gave me that text or call. I don't remember what it was. And
I stalked you, remember?
You did. Stalked you. Yes, you did.
And you fought me off for about 6 months.
Yes.
Hey, you ready to join our practice? Hey, here's what we're doing over here. Hey, Dr. Bruce, yeah. Remember me over here in the corner?
Yes. So at the end of the 3 years, now I thought at that point my contract was up, you know, mm-hmm. it so happened that I still had another couple years, but I acted like it was, you know, 3 years was up. Mm-hmm. And so I said, all right, maybe we can make this work, yeah. You know. So again, I'm good at starting things. So I said, we need to do this. We can do this,
yeah.
You know. And I liked your approach. You know, we had already had interactions, you know, with my interview with you, your interview with me, you know. And so you said, you know, come start PEDS for us. And so that's what I did. And so we have three other providers now working with us. And
you've they're trained.
Fabulous. They absolutely brilliant. Fabulous. They do their case presentations now. And I'm just so proud of them, you know.
Oh, you should be proud.
And so... so yes, I lost Sonia back in 2018 in May. It was a very, very difficult road. And so it gave me an appreciation for, families that have to go through that. And there's so many of us now who are going through that, you know, and it's not only cancer,
no, it's
you know, it's the chronic stuff. It's the, so, when I see a new little 4-year-old for the first time, and I watch him, and he paces the floor, and he can't maintain eye contact, and, you know, you call his name, and he doesn't respond. I know what that family's up against, yeah. You know.
That's the kind of empathy that is
helpful. Yes.
You can't always have
yes.
as a practitioner.
Yes. Yes. You know. So, you know, what was interesting to me was the approach in functional medicine is different than traditional. So traditional medicine, you know, you have your visit, you figure out the diagnosis so that you have a target mm-hmm. to treat, right? And so
you need a label.
You need a label, absolutely. So you get a label so that you can, you know, shoot at it. Yeah. And the more precisely you can, you feel like you can shoot at it, you know, you feel like you've accomplished your job in the 10 minutes that you have available.
Well, that's
you know?
How we're trained.
That's how we're trained.
Find the label.
That's exactly right.
Treat it.
Yep. And so, you know, as I've watched my career over 30 years now, 35, 40, feels like 400, I realized that when I first started practice, you know, right out of residency, you know, the chronic illness rate in this country in kids was 5-7% maybe. Okay. You know where we're at now? We're at 54%. This was like 2-3 years ago, and I think it's much higher now after COVID. You know, over half of our kids. So you go into a classroom with 30 kids, 16 of them are going to have some sort of a chronic issue, 16, 17 of them. One of those kids is going to have autism. Three of them are going to have ADHD, probably more. Three of them are going to have asthma, you know. You have anxiety. You have autoimmunity. You know, the autoimmunity in kids has absolutely skyrocketed. Absolutely skyrocketed.
I want to dig into that later.
Yes. Yeah. You know, when I, so 4 or 5 years ago when I started down this road, you know, I started seeing 14, 15-year-olds with positive antithyroid antibodies, you know, TPO antibodies.
So the body's that's starting to attack.
This is crazy.
The thyroid.
This is absolute craziness, you know. I mean, I remember seeing or hearing, actually, 30 years ago about Hashimoto's, you know, in adults occasionally. Now I was starting to see it in teenagers. Then 2 years later, I was seeing it in 10-year-olds. And then I was seeing it in 5-year-olds. Over the last year, we've had 2 kids at 8 months where we picked up TPO and antithyroid antibodies. Yes.
So you're screening all your kids for
this. We're screening them all now. Yes.
Good.
And so now the approach is different, you know, and we may touch on that a little bit later. But, you know, traditionally you say, well, your thyroid's still working fine. These antibodies are only slightly elevated.
We don't know what to do with that.
Don't know what to do with that. And so come back, you know, when you've got real problems. These are not real problems, you know. And so I look at those numbers and I look at the family history and I see autoimmunity. I see methylation issues. I see, you know, cancer. I see heart disease. I see mental health issues. And I know that this little kid, I know 10 years from now where he or she's going to end up, you see. And so my approach is, and this is why I like the functional approach, you see, is why not address the issues now while they're still very addressable, you see. And so
before that label has to come and throw the pharmaceuticals at it.
Yes. So it was very difficult for me to actually take these really complicated kids in 15-minute snippets. So you couldn't do that. So I was doing these hour and a half long consults, and insurance was just blowing them off because they don't cover that sort of a workup, you see. Yeah. Not only that, but in order to study these kids, you know, I was getting up at 3 a.m, you know, doing these literal studies of these kids, looking at their histories in great detail, you know. So I knew what I was up against when I actually met with them, you know. So I realized that our current both compensation system and medical record system was absolutely inadequate for these kinds of complexities, you see. And so I just set out to design my own. So you've probably seen my spreadsheet, you know. And so I told Sam when I first came aboard, I need 2 big monitors so I can put this spreadsheet up, you see. So because I want to be able to see all this information at a glance.
Well, that's how your brain works.
Yeah. You know, I don't remember details very well. I need to look at them and see where they fit together, you see. And so, and in the future, when I see, for example, a kiddo during a well check and mom starts talking about some of the stuff that we were dealing with, you know, I don't remember, you know, because a lot of these complexities sort of start blending together, you know. So I can very quickly pull up their spreadsheet and, you know, 5 seconds, I'm reoriented, you see.
Reignite
and so,
your brain,
yeah. And then I can advise, you know, very quickly. So, and I'm still using that spreadsheet to this day, you see, and I keep tweaking it and monitoring it and all that. It's not for everyone.
No one's going to question the how behind your clinic because of the end result you get.
Well,
because your outcomes are so phenomenal.
It takes a lot of effort to do that, you know, for me to come up. So I try and design a treatment plan before I even see the patient, you know, based on the history.
A lot of us kind of have to.
Yeah.
I mean, we have to study these patients.
Yes, yes.
This is a beast.
It's a beast. So there are two kinds of, so what we tried to do then in FMI was try to take and somehow force a traditional pediatric model into a functional setting. Okay. So the way that then looks is, okay, we have these 15-minute visits, which are your traditional well checks, for example, where we maintain health and make sure that, you know, baby's developing well and growth is fine and
developmental milestones.
Right. Yeah. You know, and so you can pick things up, you know, fairly quickly on those sorts of things. And if you pick things up, you know, the next comment is, you know, I have some concerns here. We need to spend more time. Yeah. So then we set that time up and then we do a deep dive. I call it a deep dive. And so most parents are good with that. Some would like to cover all that stuff in the well check. And I do not feel like we can do justice to some of these complex issues in a 15-minute well check. It just can't happen, you know. So most people are good with that.
Yeah.
And so then what is my approach to families then in the exam room, you know? So I typically meet with a new family and some, you know, I'm getting old, you know,
and
my approach is fairly direct anymore
because
we have a very short period of time and I want to figure things out quickly. So some people are kind of put off with that, but that's okay. Mm-hmm. My first task is to figure out whether this family and I and this environment are going to fit. Is this going to be a good fit? And so I'll ask some pretty pointed questions, and within about a minute, I get a pretty good feel as to whether it's a good fit or not.
You have to gauge their readiness, because what we ask them to do is difficult.
Yes.
Yeah.
Is this family here for quick fixes? Are they doing traditional stuff? They've been doctor shopping, and they don't like what they've seen, and they've heard good things, and so they're on board for another opinion.
Yeah.
So my next question for that, sort of a scenario is, okay, so if I were to tell you, you need to feed your family organic GMO-free grass-fed unprocessed, would you know what I meant? If they get a glazed look on their eyes or their eyes get big, that tells me everything I need to know. You know, if they don't know what that means, then they're literally living on a different planet than I am, than where we operate. And it's probably not going to be a real good fit. Because what I'm going to be asking them to do is going to be way beyond what they're going to be willing to do.
Because you know that what it takes, it's going to take a lot.
It's going to take a lot.
So that really brings up what we have here on the screen.
So then you see, I've got this spreadsheet, you know, where I can clinically track these kids. Then, as I started seeing lots more of these kids, you know, I started trying to create a working model that I could actually present to a family that was understandable. Mm-hmm. Okay, a process.
Yeah.
You start here, you do this, you do this, you do this. Because, you know, you can give them a list of apparently unrelated sorts of tasks, and unless they have some clue as to why they're doing what they're doing, it ain't gonna get done. It just is not gonna get done, you know? Because I know myself, it happens to me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started thinking in terms of what we just talked about just a few minutes ago on causation.
Yeah.
You know, where, why are our kids so sick? Okay. And the Academy of Pediatrics, the CDC, the three-letter agencies tend to really put a lot of emphasis on genetics. Okay. Well, I realized very quickly genetics doesn't change that fast. Maybe mitochondrial genetics, you know, is influenced, you know, with toxins and all that, but ultimately it's our environment. So then I had to start thinking, okay, so what are the kinds of things that I've seen different since 1990? What is new in our environment that didn't exist before? Well, okay, so I started counting. Well, 1995, you know, the GMO project was, you know, made official by Congress, right? And
can
so,
you identify
GMO?
GMO
stands, yeah. So I'll ask parents, do you know what GMO means? And a lot of people will know, and most will say, yeah, a little bit. So GMO stands for genetically modified organism. And so the purpose for introducing that into our food supply ostensibly was to feed the world, right?
Increase crop,
right? And so, however, when you don't have to dig real far to find real motivation, then real motivation is that, you know, you take, for example, so here's the illustration I give to my, 12-year-olds. I say, if mom has a garden, 12 by 12 garden, and plants some seeds, and you water it, and you don't do anything else to it, in about 3 months, what do you expect is going to happen to that garden? Well, they quickly realize that it's going to get overgrown with weeds, it's going to be kind of hard, and I've had this experience myself. You can't easily find where the plants are, where the tomatoes are and the peppers and all that, so you have to be weeding this stuff, you have to be attending to it. Well, now take that 12 by 12 plot and multiply it by thousands of acres, and you get an idea as to how difficult it is to maintain a weed-free corn field or right. wheat field or whatever. Right. And so, our brilliant scientists came up with this idea that, okay, we can spray, aerial spray these big fields, and the problem is, so if we kill the weeds, doesn't that kill the crop too? Yes, it does. So to prevent the crop from getting killed, we're going to modify the genetics of that crop, like corn is the prototypical example of that. We're going to alter it so that it will resist the Roundup, where the weeds will not, at least not initially. And so now you'll drive around the valley here and you'll see these pristine, gorgeous, beautiful fields, and you drive by and you go, I know how they do that. And I'm not sure that's so good for us,
And so what is that? Why is that a problem? Especially for the weeds population.
We've been told, and I remember hearing this back in the 90s, that you spray the Roundup, and you can spray the Roundup around your fruit trees and all that. Once it hits the soil, it literally disintegrates and degrades into the environment, and goes away. Well, what we found since then is that that is not the case. It does have a persisting sort of a characteristic. Not only that, we are starting to see some of the health effects of that. And so one of the more sort of in-your-face kinds of manifestations that it's 2 years ago, all these lawsuits against Monsanto before it merged with Bayer. So Bayer inherited all this stuff, So, and these were people who are literally working directly with, the groundskeepers, who are having to spray this stuff, and so we're being exposed more. And so had issues with, so it's a non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and now there's a whole row of people lined up, doing lawsuits, and Bayer is has taken some steps to try and sort of do a class action settlement for like $10 billion to make this go away. See, so
no one wants to face
it. Hopefully, right. But are they doing anything about the Roundup? No. So some of the more difficult folks to actually engage in this functional conversation are our farm families,
right,
who are caught in the middle of this, all right, so this is their livelihood.
Absolutely.
And to convince them that this is an issue is very difficult. And so on my, I created a model, that's this pyramid, and that basic foundational layer that is a must do includes things like, okay, you've got to eat GMO free, because in pediatrics, we're not dealing with the non-Hodgkin's lymphoma.
Right.
Glyphosate also binds minerals. It's a chelator. Mm-hmm. It has a patent for chelation. Mm-hmm. It's an antibiotic. It has a patent as an antibiotic 15 years ago. Okay. So what are the implications of that? Well, if I'm on a maintenance antibiotic day in and day out on a low dose, what do I expect will happen to my resident flora? Well, it's going to be very different.
Gut microbiome.
Gut microflora, microbiome. Yep. And so a lot of the last 15, 20 years at places like Stanford and Washington University in St. Louis and Harvard and, University of California, San Diego and San Francisco, all these places are doing this microbiome research and are coming up with absolutely earth-shattering findings that what we have here actually affects the rest of us, dramatically. Yeah. So I believe that since 1995 and even slightly before that, because I think they were using some of this spray before it became, wholesale approved by Congress, that we are, so when we measure, you know, we do lots of labs in kids. When we measure labs, I'm finding lots of deficiencies in zinc, lots of deficiencies in magnesium. We find lots of imbalances in gut flora. And when I see that, I look then at the past history on my flow sheet. I say, all right, how much antibiotic exposure has this youngster had? So if the family's already on board with this GMO-free organic sort of a lifestyle, when did that happen?
Right.
In other words, if it's only been in the last year or two, I mean, there's a whole history back there that with lots of antimicrobial exposure.
And
that
it's not
we
just
see.
The child, mom.
So family, right? Yes, yes. And so, yeah, if it happens to be a young kid, you know that the fetal milieu in which that baby was growing was bathed in some of this chemical stuff, you know, and glyphosate is not the only thing,
right.
You know, I mean, there's all kinds of stuff, you know, the all of the plastics and heavy metals, you know, our water, you know, I don't know if you remember 2 years ago, is it 2 years now, 2.5 years ago, there was this study that was done in our Boise school district, testing water for lead.
Yes.
And yes. I was absolutely flabbergasted. There were certain spigots that were 100 times the upper EPA limit, you know.
Yeah.
And I just, my heart sank, you know. These are kids. These are kids. That's lead. We know that what lead does to a brain, you know. You literally lose 5 to 10 IQ points, you know, over a short period of time, you know, during your developing years, you know. So, and if a mom has this stuff on board, you know, I always say, you know, that fetus serves as a dumping ground for maternal toxins.
Right. Most people don't realize that.
And so one of the key sort of pushes that I have now in functional pediatrics is let's start way back before this kiddo is even born.
Yeah.
Mom needs to take care of her issues before she thinks about even getting pregnant. So I send him to Jess. You know, say, all right, you need to go fix your issues,
yeah.
You know.
Our women's
go
health
detox.
Team. Yep.
Women's health team.
Let's start
oh, man.
Prior to conception.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe then we'll
absolutely
make differences.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes. So I think that's where the biggest difference is going to be in pediatrics is addressing issues with moms. Because you know what? We're into the, what, second, third, fourth generation now
yes.
of all this toxicity.
Yes.
You know? And so that's GMO. Well, so you can be GMO-free and not organic,
right?
Organic is the next step. Well, you know, a lot of folks will say, well, you know, that's just way too expensive, so far beyond our budget, you know. Well, okay, stick with a dirty dozen.
Yeah.
You know, yep. You can start there.
Clean 15,
clean
dirty
15,
DWG.
Yeah, avoid the dirty dozen, yeah. And so, because there you're dealing with so many other kinds of chemicals. Now, can you get away from glyphosate? No, it's pervasive, you know.
It's in our
rainwater. I tested myself, actually. Now, I was about 10% of the prevailing population, which says that, yes, you can really drop it pretty dramatically,
right.
But you can't get rid of it. And so now, this far down the road in my functional thinking, I'm thinking that it's not a bad idea for families in general annually to do a detox on themselves.
Yeah. So what's your approach to detoxification in these families?
So detoxification is been a very difficult topic in pediatrics. And the reason is everybody doesn't want to touch it. Nobody wants to touch that.
Yeah.
Every conference that I've been to nationally, you know, I'll raise my hand. Okay, so what is your, you know, we've talked about adults here.
Yeah.
What is your recommendation in kids?
Yeah.
Mom, you know, they will not touch that. And so we've had to kind of plow our own road on that, you know. And so gentle is the name of the game, gentle and slow.
Yeah.
And the reason is that you can do more damage than, or more harm than good if you go too aggressive, you know. And so you know that that brains that have autism, brains that have ADHD, brains that have huge anxiety, you know, they're toxic, you know. Lots of aluminum on board from injections that we give, you know. And by the way, the injectable aluminum that is inflammatory, much worse than any aluminum that you take by mouth, because that tends to be filtered out, you know, 99% of it. So so we put them on binders, you know. Traditionally in medicine, we have binders. You know, you go to an ER with an acetaminophen overdose, you get put on charcoal, right?
Right.
You know, because
we
know those bind very effectively. In fact, if you use them too long, and this is one of the problems in peds is, so if we put a kid on charcoal for 3 months, what makes me think that I'm not going to also pull all the good stuff out along with the bad, you see? So, you know, how do we step around that, you know? And so we've been using things like fulvic and humic and things like that that are a little bit more selective. But then when you get into mold toxins and things like that, you have to be a little bit more broad. And so then what you do is you have to pulse it, you know? You say, all right, we're going to put you on something that has charcoal and something that has zeolites in it and something that has fulvics and the humics and stuff like that, you know? Support your detoxification pathways, especially if we already know from your genetics that you're weak in that area. And by the way, if your kid is constipated, we need to fix that now. Yeah. Because it's, you know, any amount of detox that we do is going to just simply recirculate, you know, and probably make them sicker.
And is that approach working?
And that approach seems to be working, yeah.
Good.
You know, what's interesting is we'll have some of these kids who acutely come in with what looks like a PANS or PANDAS sort of a situation, you know, with twitches and abnormal neurological movements. And you know, that's brain inflammation, you know. Yep. Or fresh onset seizures, you know. And so we'll put them on some of this this detox. And I've seen some very dramatic results, you know, within 2 weeks, the stuff just simply goes away.
Wow.
And you know, here's another very interesting twist. When we take a kid like that and we put them on, say, a gluten, dairy, soy-free diet, which is the inflammatory proteins, right, and the okay. sugars, and the whole family decides to do that together, then I'll hear things like, oh, yeah, we did that for a month or two. And, yeah, dad's headaches went away. And, mm-hmm. you know, Susie quit wetting the bed. And
we're all sleeping
it's
better.
Just it's just craziness, you know. Yeah. And it basically illustrates how broadly affected our food supply is to our health, to so many different things in our health, you know. And so to me, it's a no-brainer. You know, a lot of our medications that we use are maybe 30%, 40% effective, you know. Mm-hmm. But when you have something that's like a gluten, dairy, soy-free diet that is like 50 to 70% effective in most things that you do, it's a no-brainer to actually do that on all these kids with chronic issues, you see.
Yeah.
And so, yes, I will put them on a gluten, dairy, soy-free diet, but they have to be doing that first layer.
Yeah.
You know, the organic GMO-free grass-fed, and the grass-fed is kind of a natural follow-through, you know, of right. the organic GMO-free.
Right.
Because if you have a lot-fed cow that's being fed GMO corn, you know, you're not yeah. helping the situation,
you're
know.
You're not just what you eat, yeah. you are what your food eats.
Yes, and then you have the kids who just can't sit still, and they're twitchy, and they're hyper, and they can't focus on anything, you know. And so, yes, I know that there's some genetics going on, but I also know when I look over their little, you know, health history, my timeline, that this kid is eating a standard American diet,
yeah.
very highly processed. So processed food stays cheap, you know, because it's production line, just like our cars.
Yeah.
You know, we can afford a lot of our food now. So, you know, I tell parents, you know, who worry about the cost, you know, 50 years ago, I think more like 15 to 20% of our family budget went to food. Mm-hmm. Now it's about 1% to 2%.
Yeah.
Well, that's because it's very highly processed. Well, in order to sell processed food, you better flavor it. Otherwise, nobody would buy it, right?
And market to children.
And then that's right. Yeah. Because kids, you know, tend to pull on mom's, you know, skirt string. And so, you know, so how do they flavor it? The MSG is probably one of the biggest flavoring agents. MSG is monosodium glutamate. Glutamate is a neuroexcitotoxin, right? And so you have a kid in the brain that's already hyperactive, and then you introduce very large amounts of this glutamate, and you have a recipe for disaster, you know?
How about
it's like Chinese restaurant syndrome on steroids,
yeah.
you know?
Oh, my goodness.
And so what did you ask?
Food dyes.
Food, same. Yeah. yeah. All this stuff. Absolutely. Yeah. yeah. Especially the ADHD kids, you know. Feingold, you know, did a lot of work back mm-hmm. 40 years ago, you know, on food dyes. And when you take it seriously, it does help a lot. You know, it depends on your detox pathways. A lot of the genetics then becomes involved as to whether things work or not.
Yeah.
When you look at the Autism Research Institute's has a sheet. For a variety, they rate a variety of different interventions for things, for neuropsych issues, you know, ADHD, autism, that sort of thing. They rate diet, you know, food, supplements, medications, and then parents rate, you know, what has been the most effective in, you know, helping their kids. Diet is always like 30 plus medications down to around one and sometimes minus one because of the side effect issues, you see.
Yes. I think what we're also not addressing, we as just a medical, you know, arena in general, is the toxins, potentially GMOs, fillers in the pharmaceuticals.
Yes. Yes.
So it's like you're trying to fix a problem, but then you're just impacting that total tox burden in that child or that
MMR human. Vaccine has glyphosate in it.
Gosh, does it really?
Yes. Crazy.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Oh.
And we're injecting it direct, you know.
Yeah.
And then I say, okay, and then I touch upon a very, very sensitive button and I say, you know what? You need to limit your kids' screen time to an hour a day.
Oh, that's a whole nother conversation.
That's a whole huge thing, but that's part of that that must do.
You have it on
list.
There.
You see, it's on there.
Not just the blue light, which I know you talk about a lot, but it's also the EMF.
It's the EMF. Damaging. It's the Wi-Fi router that you know. You know, and I tell parents you need to go back to the old days, like 5 years ago. You know, when we used to plug in the Ethernet cable, you know, to our devices. You know, that's ancient technology now. You see,
we almost can't even do it sometimes.
You
People
almost
don't
can't
know how
do
to
it.
Do it.
That's right. That's right. And so. So there, just like the farmers, you know, with the glyphosate, you know, it's the IT guys, it's the IT dads, you know, who, have a really hard time wrapping their brain around that, you know? And so I give them data from, Martin Paul, for example, you know, PhD up in Washington State University, you know, who's done a lot of the work on what they call the voltage sensitive calcium channels in the brain that open up. You know, the slightest provocation by voltage from the outside that allow calcium to pour in and make these brains absolutely crazy, you know.
I love watching you. I've seen you on the exam table paper, draw.
Yes.
Draw images of that to teach parents or draw the methylation cycle or detox impairment because we have to make it real for these parents.
They
have to see what's going on.
It has to be real
kids.
For my brain first, right?
Okay, you too. But you also really help us as moms visualize what's going on in their little body.
Yeah, and so when I, you know... I try and make it real for them because I will tell you that if they do not take care of the EMF stuff, well, here's what Klinghart says up in Seattle. He says, if you don't take care of this, I can't generally get you better.
Yeah. There's some what we call non-negotiables.
It's huge. Mm-hmm. And then so the blue light is a separate issue, you know, affects the melatonin. We think, well, it's, you know, I can use blue blockers and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, the reality is that melatonin that we're suppressing so much actually is one of our massive antioxidants in the mitochondria that counters some of that oxidative stress that we've got day in and day out. Yeah. And without having enough of that, you can't get a kid better, you know, because a lot of these kids have these mutations, we call them SNPs, single nucleotide polymorphisms, that don't allow them, for example, to burn off their or neutralize their superoxide dismutase, which is one of the sort of the byproducts of oxidative metabolism in the mitochondria, right?
Yeah.
If we had time, we could geek on that a little bit.
Well,
but I don't know
I'm
going to
make
time.
You come back.
Okay.
We'll have to do another episode where we can geek out on mitochondrial health.
Yeah.
That's a really big deal
that's
for
huge.
All of our patients.
Absolutely huge.
But I know you're really focused on that.
So... And then once they're doing that, and I'll tell them, you know, a lot of people will say, well, you know, just tell me what supplements to use.
Right.
They want to go to the middle or to the top of the pyramid. And I say, well, so imagine if you will, and I'll tell this to a 14-year-old. Imagine mama tells you to go water this tree outside. You know, it's springtime. We need to start watering. So it gives you a bucket. You go outside and you stand there with a hose and you start daydreaming, you know, and pretty soon you're back, you know, expecting this thing to be overflowing. And there's no water coming over the top. And you look down inside, and there's no water in the bucket. And you look down further, you know, and you realize that it's full of holes in the bottom.
Yeah.
You're never going to fill the bucket unless you plug the holes.
Yeah.
So the first layers are those holes that need to be plugged. I mean, you can throw supplements till you're blue in the face. You know, you're basically, literally, it is true what the traditional docs say, you're making expensive urine.
Right.
You know, if you don't fix the
you're
holes,
trading polypharmacy that our traditional care does for polysupplementation.
Yes.
And it's, that really root cause medicine?
And functional medicine has been, you know, kind of criticized for that sometimes, you know?
Yeah, we have been. Yeah.
So if a family is wanting just a quick fix with vitamins, I have to spend more time convincing them or they're in the wrong place because they're using that same mentation of fix me now so I can go back the way I was living before I got sick. That's not going to work, you know.
Pill for an L.
Yeah, because I can fix that temporarily, but you're going to be back with the same issues, you know, or worse.
Dr. Bruce, we could sit here for 6 hours. Yeah. I'm craving more information from you, just as one of your colleagues and as a mom, and I know our listeners are as well. I always end my interviews with, if you had to mention one idea or one recommendation that moves the needle the most for your patient population, what would it be? I feel like you just answered that in the last however
long.
Yes,
I kind of sort of poked ahead a little bit there. My encouragement for young parents is to take care of your own health issues before you even think about getting pregnant, because yeah. The condition of your health before pregnancy, before conception, and during your pregnancy has a massive influence on what happens with your kid. It is well known that inflammation of any kind, including caused by emotional stress, emotional trauma, toxic stress, toxic trauma, infectious trauma during pregnancy, is a very high risk for developing autism and neurodevelopmental issues as a child. Fix your issues before you think about bringing kids into the world, you know. Once they're here, so here's a little illustration that I used to use. I don't use it much anymore because I'm doing my consults online now. And so, but imagine, you know, your life is like a Y, I say. You know, you're walking along. Something happens at some point to veer you off in the direction of your straight walk up in one direction, okay? And usually it's some, I don't know, infection or it's some trauma or something happens, okay? You can pick it up on a lab, you can pick it up on symptoms or whatever. The sooner you recognize what's happening and fix the triggers and move back to the straight line or to the other fork in the Y, the shorter the distance is. The farther you let that go, the farther that distance is between the two legs and the longer it takes, if you can even get there, you see. And so the closest point to that initial event is before you even get, before you even conceive.
Before you veer, yeah.
Before you even conceive. Yeah. So if you can go way, way back, you know, a lot of the stuff that we're seeing will go away. Now, once you're here, then I would say you've got to be doing that first line.
Yep.
You know, you got to be watching what the kids are doing online, how much blue light exposure, how much EMF exposure. You've got to be watching what they're eating. You got to be filtering your water. The absolute basic things, you know, that are they're so different than they were 30, 35 years ago, you know.
Unfortunately.
I say we need to go back to living the way we were living pre-1990.
For so, you know, many reasons.
We can learn how to use current technology safely. Yeah. You know, I'm not going to say because you can be a road statistic to not drive your car. Right. I will say you need to wear your seatbelt, you know, obey the traffic lights and don't drive drunk, you know. Right. I'm not saying you get rid of your devices. I'm saying hardwire them.
Yeah.
You know, limit the time.
Be aware.
Yeah.
Oh, it's such good advice. Thank you so much, Dr. Bruce, for your time. We're excited to have you on. Thank you for listening to the Functional Medicine Foundations podcast. For more information on topics covered today, programs offered at FMF, and the highest quality of supplements and more, go to funmedfoundations.com.